Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Fantasy and Adventure, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This is your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the historical fantasy Falcon series, beginning with The Falcon Flies Alone. Today, we'll be talking with A.L. Kless, the author of The Lost Puzzler. A.L. Kless enjoys a triple international career as a performing violinist, teacher in a Buchmann Mehta School of Music, and an author of novels. Born in Israel, Eyal has traveled the world extensively, living several years in Dublin, London, Manchester, and Vienna, before returning to Tel Aviv. As an author, Eyal published his first novel, Rocha's Violin, in Hebrew. The Lost Puzzler, published by HarperCollins Voyager, is his first novel in English. Eyal's website is eyalkless.com, and he loves to hear from readers. His first name is E-Y-A-L, and his last name is K-L-E-S-S, and that's his website. Before I welcome him on the show, I'd like to share my review of his novel. A picaresque novel about a serious boy with special powers. The Lost Puzzler takes place in an impoverished, technologically backwards world. After the fall of the advanced Tarakan Empire, the remaining population struggles to get by on what remains of their technology. Others turn to rural existence, adhering to religious dogma, which condemns all those who still seek out the old technology. Children who spontaneously exhibit tattoos are linked to the fallen Tarakanian society, sought after by those who collect Tarakanian technology, and ostracized or killed by the religious rural faction. Two boys, born years apart, both possess the markings which indicate special powers. One, Rafik, flees death in his religiously conservative village only to be passed from hand to hand as various factions try to make use of his powers. Rafik possesses one of the most useful mutations, the ability to open the locks that guard caches of the lost Tarkanian technology. Those locks are made of intricate puzzles that can only be solved by a puzzler, someone who has the power to arrange symbols into patterns. The other tattooed young man, whose only mutation is the ability to see through materials, is a scribe in the Society of Historians. Decades later, he is tasked with finding out what happened to Rafik and why it changed the course of history for the worse. An elusive fighter and communications specialist, the alluring Vincha, knows most of Rafik's story, but our scribe must find a way to convince her to talk. Unfortunately, he's not the only one looking for Vincha. So let's go ahead and welcome Eyal. I'd like to welcome Eyal Kless onto the air today.
talking about his book. And how are you doing today, Eyal? Or tonight, rather?
It's tonight in Israel, but thank you. It's great. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm really excited about answering your questions.
Okay, my pleasure. We'll jump right in. So this book is about Rafik. He's a puzzler, and his ability consists of unlocking puzzle boxes, which guard Tarkanian technology. His talent evolves as he sees and dreams about walls of unfamiliar symbols. He must identify hidden commonalities among those symbols in order to form a pattern. Your other character, the young historian, only referred to by his nickname of Twinkle Eyes, who is piecing together the story of Rafik, has a puzzle as well. He needs to find out what happened to Rafik and why it affected the course of history. Would you say there are some similarities in the way they piece together information trying to discern patterns?
It's amazing that first question is really, I never thought about it like that. But when you ask me this, I kind of think this is very logical way. I might have done it subconsciously. Mm-hmm. That basically Twinkle Eyes is basically going through all this information. Some of it is false. So some of it is like false symbols. And it's trying to create a pattern in which to understand what happened. What happened to history? What happened to Rafik? Why did Armageddon happen? And in the meantime, he's learning about Rafik and his abilities. So I would say that, I guess, that was just one of those scenes that was running in my mind consciously and subconsciously when I was writing.
Yeah, that's the fun of reading authors' work and sometimes seeing what seems to be happening in the background. It seems like both of the characters, the young man and the boy, have strong analytical abilities that they apply. Speaking about their age, Rafik is in his early teens for most of the story. Twinkle Eyes can't be that much older, although he's not a virgin anymore.
Yeah.
The mutant historian, Twinkle Eyes, he was loved by his parents, and he found a safe haven among the historians, while Rafik was exploited by a series of mercenary men. But how different are their lives actually? Has Twinkle Eyes been used as well?
Well, without putting much, too many secrets of this, what happens in the story, I definitely think the Twinkle Eye has been used. Basically, both of them are working, their lives are basically lives that have no power, they don't have any power on their own lives. I mean, even Twinkle Eyes, that in the onset of the book, is looking like, know-it-all, very wise guy, walking around the city, knowing where to do all his secrets. It's basically, as the book progresses, as the novel progresses, he is discovered to be just a pawn, or basically maybe not a pawn, maybe more significant, a piece on the board, but still just another gaming instrument of this, the whole story that unfolds. So both him and, of course, Rafik, a 13 years old boy with very exceptional talents, that's basically being, moved around and used in all this, all ways. So yes, there's definitely a similarity between both of them.
Right, they don't really, even though they're both powerful in their own ways, they don't have much agency. Well, the title of your work is The Lost Puzzler, and the title could be interpreted several ways. Has the puzzler been lost, or is he lost?
Well, definitely it starts with the fact that the puzzler is lost. But the story of Rafik put me, to tell the story of Rafik, I had to go through two unconventional methods of trying to tell the story. Because first of all, I'm 47, about to be 48. And when I wrote this, even when I started when I was 20, in my 20s, to go into the eyes of a child or a 13-year-old boy and see how he relates to a very alien world. It was very difficult for me in the beginning, and I made several mistakes which I had later to edit out or edit in. But then again, as the reader basically learns about Rafiq and learn about his abilities and start to relate to him and what this child is going through, in with an eyes of a grown up. That was supposed to, the book was never supposed to be a YA. I didn't go for younger readers. I went for older, mature readers. But then in around the last part of this book, as he becomes a full puzzler is kind of an alien in the forms of how he relates to the world. And so more and more this character, which we learned to relate to, is starting to distance itself from the reader. And the reader knows less and less of what Rafiq is thinking. So in some ways, we also losing the puzzler as we read him.
Yes, so, in some ways he almost loses his humanity or accessibility. He seems like he isn't as involved with people anymore as his story progresses, because the puzzles begin to fascinate him so much.
Exactly. And he sees the world in a different way. And the way I imagine it is that puzzlers, when they are absolutely in the highest of their ability, don't see the world the way other human beings see it. So it was impossible to describe, but I could only slowly move him back a little bit and put more other characters to the fore. So in some ways, he's lost to us mm-hmm. in the book. So, but both the answer for both of the short accents is yes.
So the puzzler is almost a bit, one could almost compare a puzzler to a genius, in that the mental processes are so different that a gulf opens up between a puzzler and just humans that drink and get into relationships and stuff.
Yes, it's like when I know the movie Amadeus. I'm a musician, mm-hmm. and I saw when I was young, and the way that Amadeus was portrayed by suddenly this manic laugh that comes out of his, like, this kind of laugh that comes out of nowhere, and it's exactly to put him in. Here's a character you don't know why he's laughing like that, and he's just a way of him portraying a person who's so such a genius that he's almost detached from humanity through that laugh. So I was trying to kind of see how the more he progresses and the more he becomes more aware of what has happened, the less we are aware of him. And if a 22nd century persona would have materialized in the 19th century, how would other people perceive him or her in their abilities? They might look at him or her as a magician, or or a spellcaster, or some genius. And it's just the way that this distance is very hard to bridge. And so this way, Rafiq starts very close to the reader, and then slowly distances himself away from humanity and from the reader.
Yes, because he's being drawn towards an advanced civilization and being drawn into the secrets of an advanced civilization. So he starts off from a village, a very kind of a conventional village, or a conservative village, we could say. Prayer is a part of daily life. Women have strictly defined roles. Mutant children who manifest tattoos, as Rafiq does, are exiled or even killed. Do you find that religion can be an oppressive force?
Absolutely. This has nothing to do with belief or individual belief or whatever people believe in. Religion, when it becomes like a collective force, can be violent and oppressive. It can also do good things, but in history, as history proved, it went both ways. So I wanted to be a little bit careful when it came to portraying religion, mm-hmm. So because the name Rafiq refers to Middle Eastern or Arabic origins, and then but I've basically made a Judeo-Muslim new religion out of and basically made it all up and try to kind of stay neutral and not being portrayed as somebody who's saying something about certain religion. So I just made up a Judeo-Muslim, partly called maybe Christian as well, religion together, mash it all up together. And basically it's not about the religion itself. It's about what the people in the village believed that the tattoos were. Mm-hmm. So, and that's how this whole book starts.
We could say it's kind of just a Old Testament type religion, because after all, those religions all do have a common root.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're right. Old Testament kind of religion. Absolutely. But the way that they're related to the tattoos has nothing to do with religion. It has to do more with how they as a society see the marked ones. And as he goes through the world, there are other societies, some of them not religion, who relate to the tattoos in different ways. Some of them adore them or use them, and other fear them and hate them. So it's really nothing about religion. It's really more about just how we perceive the person who is different than us.
Well, and that brings us to the Salvationists, who are part of another cultural group. That sounds like a religious name, but they don't ever talk about religion. I was thinking they might more accurately be called the Salvagenists, although there is no such word. Their lives revolve around the dangerous work of salvaging Tarkanian technology. They're a hard-drinking and violent lot. But would you say also that they're looking for salvation in their own way?
Well, first of all, I must say that I wish I would have thought about that word before as I was writing, because that's a really good Salvationist. I just thought about, solving something, and then Salvationist just came naturally to me. Mm-hmm. I imagine them as the ultimate mercenaries. And the people that basically, some of them are doing things to survive, some are doing this for greed. But there's also characters who are doing this for more philosophical reasons. And there are at least two characters there who are Salvationists. One of them is a commander, another one is a kind of a person who teaches puzzles to Rafiq. And they both look at what they do or did as in a more philosophical way. They are trying to basically better humankind, bring humankind back from where it fell after a world disaster and the catastrophe. Then they're trying to bring it back.
Well,
and so for them to go to those bunkers and salvage all this technology is more than just money. It's about, and so you can say that some of them are looking for salvation and some of them are just looking for loot.
I think it's interesting to reflect on. There are, much like our own world, there are people who look for salvation in the divine, in that they are looking for something that's inexplicable, that can't be explained, that has to be experienced through faith alone. And there are other people who look for salvation in science and technology because they really believe that those things can improve life for all of mankind.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and in some ways, they are also, each and every one of them is looking for a salvation the way you're looking, but not all of them are aware that they're looking for it.
Well, that makes for an interesting story, of course. So Rafiq is befriended by one of the Salvationists, a woman called Vincha, who learns his story, and she's one of our narrators. At one point, Vincha finds Rafiq as he's preparing to pray. She shares what she does instead of praying when she finds a quiet place. She likes to listen to music she found through her work as a Salvationist. Later, the music is revealed to be Beethoven's. And you're a professional violinist. Is listening to music your form of communion with the divine?
I'm an atheist Jew, but I always say to everybody who listens that if there's something that shakes my non-belief beliefs, are, you know, Bach and Mozart and Beethoven. Because I do believe that if aliens just landed right now and said, show us what humanity has achieved, not just in the source of technology, because, you know, they'll have better technology than us. They just landed on Earth. But what did you do? Mm-hmm. What did you manage yourself? And I would say Beethoven's music is definitely something I would show as where we went. And so yes, I think that sometimes some kind of genius, what that has as it manifests itself in music, which is the only art form which really penetrates the body with sound waves, and affects us. It affects us. It physically affects us. Good sounds physically affect us, and also, of course, bad sounds physically affect us every day. We are surrounded by terrible noise most of our daily life. And then when suddenly you can just sit back and just listen to really divine music, I think it's one of those moments in my life that I find solace and quiet.
Well, as an atheist Jew, you could just say that music stirs you profoundly. And we'll leave it like that.
Okay.
So in your book, we have trolls, and a specific example of the trolls are the Kongs. Those are people with augmented body parts, which enable them to fight better, or in the case of Kongs, they receive communications through wires. Those people play a large role in your book, and some of them are presented sympathetically. However, the two heroes of your book, Rafik and Twinkle Eyes, have natural mutations. They don't need augmentations. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. First of all, in regards to puzzlers versus other mutants, because there are other mutants, other kinds of trolls. Some of them are stronger or faster or can lift things or shoot better. And, you know, of course, communication trolls as well. Each of them with their own unique abilities, but puzzlers are the only ones which are natural. They don't attach anything to their bodies. That's what that's the only thing they do. And there is a good explanation why in the book, don't want to give a spoiler, but there is an absolute explanation why that is. Mm-hmm. And I think basically, there is a price to pay, and we'll talk about it maybe a little later. There was a price to pay for attaching Tarakan technologies to the body, because the body rejects an alien device in the body, and so they are in some ways pure. I mean, even Twinkle Eyes, who has the ability to see, he did not attach other devices to his eyes. He just uses them in a natural way because he was just an historian. He could just see in the dark, and that was fine for him. He didn't search for anything more, but other trolls, other people who are mutants who are trying to better their better themselves have went and started attaching alien technology to their bodies. Some of it so much so that it become grotesque. So in some ways, yes, for me, Rafik is still pure. The puzzlers are the pure ones, the ones who see the talent and just work with the talents, and everybody else are basically maybe a little bit more greedy. Become more powerful. They join the race to become just better and stronger and powerful. And so they have to also pay a price.
Oh, so I think that just answers part of the next question. Because the segue into that was that trolls do suffer pain and illness from their use of artificial appendages. In fact, they have to take skint. That's a sought-after drug made from the secretions of their enemies, who are lizard-like beings that attack salvationist crews. By the way, I was wondering if you knew that there really is a psychoactive amphibian compound that can be taken, although I don't know anyone who's ever taken it. The Bufo toad is actually the source.
I know somebody who took it.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. And that's a long story, and maybe not for this moment. But yes, I mean that you hit the nail right in the head. I mean that was my idea. I knew that it told exists. I knew that this can happen. You know, some people actually can do this. And basically, I just transferred that to the book because I thought, in some ways, this also represents the true barbarism with cannibalism is eating your enemy is where how low does humanity fallen, and this for me was a very important symbol to put in the book that this is how far we went.
Yeah, that they're actually grinding up their enemies, just like a New Guinea tribe might be eating the brain of the smart chieftain that stood up to them. It does seem, I mean, some of the trolls are sympathetic, but as you said, some of them are somewhat grotesque too, because they attach so many things to themselves that they look unbalanced, and it's such a painful process. And so now, taking your previous comment into account, I understand why you made it be a painful process, because you feel that the trolls are just after power and they're greedy for that power. And so they continue to attach appendages and try to be bigger. Is that right then?
Well, there is a very, I don't want to put too many spoilers out. There is a, when I wrote it, I was really concerned about trying to give answers to any questions I raise. And most of it I try to close in the book. So when time you finish the novel, you understand what happened. You understand why Skint is. You understand why people are. And I think that the whole idea of people attaching this device to themselves in the onset was not maybe the original plan of why those instruments are there or why the tattoos appeared. But this is somehow evolution they just started doing it, and then when their body started rejecting it, they found a way around it, which was skinned. So this is for me the genius of, you know, sometimes you see like animals that live off each other, like, you know, this kind of a bug that lives in the brain of a creature and makes of the rat and makes him more courageous, so it's eaten by the cat, and then the cat gets this, and then the cat hosts it. I mean, there's a real one like that, and then he puts it out in his droppings, and then the mouse eats the dropping, and he gets the bug back. I mean, this is an incredible. How does a creature evolve? How did that happen? So this kind of thing, like the amazing, sometimes the amazing way that creatures live side by side, the symbiotic way that they live each other. This is what I thought about when I thought about attaching items to our body and what is the price that could be, that needs to be paid for it.
Yeah, those life cycles, like fungi and parasites have those, which are get very involved and go through several different hosts in order for the life cycle to continue. Exactly, things like malaria or schistosomiasis. So,
yeah, absolutely.
The Tarkanian cities began with trade guilds, and the Tarkanian cities have been inhabited again with new trade guilds. The trade guilds employ their own salvationist crews to seek out lost treasure. And some trade guilds become stronger than others and continue to gain power. So, as I mentioned, we eventually learn that the Tarkanians themselves began as a trade guild. And what is the determining factor in a guild surpassing all the other ones?
Take the word guild and transfer it to the word company, and, you know, the involvement of companies into super companies. So we think about Google and Facebook and Microsoft and all, you know, all these, it's basically, again, like human involvement, companies evolve like this. And on the way, many of them die or fall or disappear, and but those who survive are very, very strong and could really now influence the entire course of human history. So I think it's in our blood to not just trade, but also to form together strong societies. And there is almost nothing stronger and more natural to us than a certain tribe. Our brain is, until today, is basically built for us to know between 100 and 120 people. That's according to, you know, research. So basically, this is as big as our tribe should be. And that's a company, 100, 120 people. That's basically the people in the building of your company, or basically the people, maybe a minor company spread around, and you talk to them on Skype. Which means for me, that will be the normal way of people to get back together if suddenly there are no states and the planet has only 5% of the population that is now. So it's basically empty. You will form around people that you can relate to and remember and have strong bonds with. And then once that tribe is being formed, it's your tribe against other tribes. Nations happen through with hundreds of years, but basically that is a very unnatural form for us to live in.
Aren't you talking about the work of the famous Israeli philosopher? I can never pronounce his name. Do you know who I mean?
Chomsky? Are you talking about Chomsky?
Yeah, no, not Chomsky, but this entire Sapiens, the book Sapiens, I believe, discusses that.
Yes, absolutely. And his name escapes me as well. But yes, I mean, I learned that from that. I learned that after I finished the book. But it showed me that my instincts about what would happen. A lot of the time, I would sit down and try to be as realistic as I can be with the knowledge that I have. What would happen if suddenly you are alone in the world? You have 5% of the people in the world left, and most of them are in rural states. Like most, all the cities are destroyed. And so if you're a survivor in a rural place, who do you relate to and what do you do to survive? And how now move forward four generations, not just on the day it happens, move forward four generations, 60, 70, 80, 100 years. Do you think there will still be countries? I don't think so. I think people will go back to living in tribes. And if there is something bigger is formed, like a city, then they will still form guilds so they could feel naturally related to each other.
Mm-hmm. So that size between 100 and 120 is a natural size for humans. Actually, what I was getting at in that question, though, and I'll tell you, because you addressed it in a specific paragraph in your book, and it's not a spoiler, but the determining factor why one guild would get better than all the other guilds and get power, you wrote, is that guild finding a special technology. And you gave the example of the crossbow. And that just resonated for me.
Yes. I mean, that for me was not just a guild. That was nation building. I mean, you had a nation, you had an empire, and then, you know, somebody that, you know, finds out like something which is technologically better than you, actually, like spears with you know, better spears or cavalry, and then suddenly you're destroyed, you're dust, and they live as an empire until somebody else finds something which is better. So technologically, evolvement has all the time been just completely drawn from human kind. Need to evolve, but it's the need for humankind to evolve. A lot of it has been to better themselves from others.
Mm-hmm.
So, the use of technology itself, many of the times have been bad, or just not, or the way we see it as bad. If we look at it from a moral point of view.
Right, right. Well, you did some very intricate world building. And just to finish up our conversation today, part of your world building was creating a special vocabulary such as trolls. Can you explain why you chose the word rust as a curse word?
Rust, yeah. I mean, choosing a language in this situation where you think the world has been destroyed and, you know, four generations later, how would they speak? I mean, I could have chosen that they spoke in Shakespearean English and somehow made a use for it. But I thought that at least, I would think that there will be many language, like languages or parts of the same country that speaks, let's say, English, that will speak different dialects. And because I'm starting this from a city that is based on metal, people are attaching metal augmentations to themselves. What is the worst thing that will happen to you if you attach something from metal? That it would rust. And so, you know, many of my curses involve rust or, you know, don't snap my wires, or, you know, I don't give a silver wire, which I thought it was one of the funnest things to do is to think about curse words in this, which we would just not be in the normal curse words, which would just, was just too easy. I could have just basically used the words we use today, but I would be so much fun to just invent just a little different. And it's amazing how my beta readers immediately comment that they get it, that it sounds like a curse, you know, go rust in a corner.
Yeah,
that sounds like a curse. It's not exactly a curse, but it absolutely sounds like it has bad intentions immediately. So, and I got even more imaginative about the curses with in the sequel. I went a little bit further. Which was a lot of fun.
Rust has that, it's four letters and it's got that kind of hard sound to it, like the other curse word that you use in a book, which we're not going to say on air, which is a common curse word, but rust, it sounds very fitting. Now, you just mentioned a sequel, so I guess you've been working on that. Tell us where things are at with the sequel.
I am so excited about The Puzzler's War. I'm so excited about it because it took me 25 years to write the first book from beginning to when it was published. Mm-hmm. And it, four countries and seven computers, and it was lost and then it was found. And I never dared. I didn't dare. And even when I was writing it in them and I got an agent and suddenly things were happening, I thought, wow, you know, that's it. I just wrote one book. And then my agent went back and said, it's a two-book deal. They want a second book immediately. And I went, of course, by the contract. And then I went like, oh, my God, I've got to write another book. And the first book just defined where I went. I mean, the first book invented a world, but the second book had to work within the boundaries that just invent another world. I had to deal with the world and the characters that I've created. And so for a while, I thought, oh, I really like the first book, and I'll hammer in a mediocre work. I really did. I just said, okay, I'll just do what I can, and if it will be mediocre, then it's fine. And it turned out that the second book is, in my opinion, better than the first.
So you're very pleased.
I'm so pleased. And the one thing which is very, it's different, makes it very different and maybe more interesting, is that the first book has only characters within the timeline of the 15 years. So they're all in the same world. In the second book, there are also two characters that come from the 24th century. Not ancient, but they are two characters that know how it was before. Mm-hmm. And they see the world as it is now. And so they relate to the world like, oh, you know, in the old world or the new world, I could grow my own organs. I could just grow if I wanted to. But now I had to harvest the liver from a human being if I wanted to survive. So, I mean, that's a character that comes from the 24th century relating. And I had a lot of fun writing it. And I'm really excited, and I hope that people who like the first book will be delighted with the second one. So, yeah.
Do you have a publication date for the second one yet?
Yes. The second one is coming out in the UK on the 23rd of January and the US on the 28th of January 2020.
Okay, so everyone can be looking for that. And they can visit your website for more information and updates too.
Absolutely, absolutely. I love to hear from people who read the book. And I read all the critics, the good ones and the not so good ones. And I learn from everything that I read, because that's the one thing which I love, which I take with me for music, because when you play music, you learn to listen to criticism of others all your life. And so I just read what people think, and some of, you know, I got some really warm reviews, and I got a few people who didn't like it, and I read that as well and learned from that as well. So so everybody are welcome to write me their opinions about the book, and I hope they enjoyed at least as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on the show today, Yayo.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to us today on New Books Network Fantasy and Adventure Channel. I've been talking to A.L. Kless about his first novel in English, The Lost Puzzler. To find out more about A.L., you can visit his website and sign up to receive updates. His website is his name, A.L. Kless, that's spelled EYALKLESS.com. I'm your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the historical fantasy Falcon series, which begins with The Falcon Flies Alone. You can also follow me on Twitter to get updates about new podcasts and more, at Gabrielle Author. My name is spelled G-A-B-R-I-E-L-L-E. Thanks for joining us, and see you next month.